number sheet that talks about the base in each category of education, higher ed and workforce development, K-12 and early childhood learning, and the base amount of money that each division started out with. Also, what the targets were that were approved by the budget resolution that was adopted last week, and the difference over base, which is almost $1.5 billion additional dollars to spend between the divisions. And the divisions are broken down so you can tell which each division had to use to appropriate as they deliberate. In the talks which led up to the budget resolution, I took the results of the small groups that you worked in last week and the week before and informed the decision makers of what your priorities were. And that included the priorities of the people in the audience that participated so willingly also. And I think it made a significant difference. I think the fact that the education divisions had already been talking among themselves on what their priorities were, and then to have this committee offer their priorities through the group process, I think was significant and made a significant difference. And that's how we got to $1.5 billion more dollars in education total. And I think that's a good thing. And on the agenda for the agenda today, I thought that perhaps the best use of our time would be for the public to be able to respond, if they wish, to the budget resolution and to the targets as they apply to the three divisions. And this would be the last opportunity for the public to have input to the division members that, or the committee members that serve on the various divisions. Now, Representative Slawick, Early Childhood Learning Division, is just about finished with their task and with their bill. But K-12 is still way in the process, and higher education and workforce development is way into the process, so you can still have influence there, perhaps more than Representative Slawick. Plus, Representative Slawick had the least margin on her target. However, it was about the exact amount that we worked with in this committee. So to speculate on, so we have people that are willing to testify, and I will call on them. And if they're not here, maybe we'll get back to them or not. Representative Heidgerken.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a couple questions. We're going to be hearing the omnibus bills in here as well. What is the schedule? Do you know?
Yes, I do know.
Thank you.
I think I know. Darn, I left it. We were scheduled for early childhood on Wednesday, K-12 on Thursday, and higher ed on Friday. But I talked with Chairman Slawick this morning, and she said they would definitely be prepared to offer the early childhood bill during this time, our regular committee time, next week, on Monday. And so early childhood will be on Monday. K-12 will still be on Thursday, and it will be, I believe, during the K-12 time period and in the K-12 room. And on Friday, I believe higher ed is at 12:30. during the regular higher ed time. That's next Friday. Higher ed Friday, K-12 will be Thursday, and early childhood will be during this regular time slot on Monday. And so we saved you one extra meeting this week. I don't know how that's going to work out with at these different time spots on Thursday and Friday with all your other committees, but we'll have to make do. And I'm also, since you brought it up, and the question came up in another committee today, I think there was the intention of the people that put the schedule together, the committee schedule together and the committees together and formed this overarching committee, that this would serve like the old Ways and Means Committee did in the last two previous administrations, so that if there are amendments, they will be done, a lot of amendments or on the omnibus bills, they will be done in this committee and very carefully discussed, and the dialogue should take place in this committee rather than in finance or ways and means, although they still can. But the real work of education, omnibus bills, should be done then by the time they leave this committee and go to finance. And that leads us into the 24-hour rule. It should be carefully observed, as carefully as possible. But I think that there could be a problem with the higher ed bill. Probably not with the K-12 bill, though, because I think that's going to get out in time. But the higher ed, if any committee is squeezed, it's going to be the higher ed one.
Okay. To that, Madam Chair. Yeah, my understanding is that, I just speak with Representative Riley, and she had told me that she would have the bill by our desk on Friday, broke over the weekend, so it's expected to be done. So,
and so
you're
then
right.
You'll have plenty of time for your amendment.
Thank you.
Yeah. Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm looking, when you said the K-12 on Thursday at 2:15 will be meeting, and they'll be meeting in the room that the K-12 finance would be normally meeting, is that it? But this is the committee that will be meeting at that point in time, right? And that's presenting amendments?
Mm-hmm. That's correct.
Is that a problem if other people are in committees, et cetera? Do we need to be sure that, can they be excused? I mean, we would need, it seems to me, we need everybody from this committee at those hearings for omnibus if we're making the final decisions, right?
If this is their priority, they will be here.
Okay.
Representative
Garofalo. Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Peterson, I believe, if I'm understanding the chair properly, it's that the K-12 division will not be meeting at that time.
That's correct.
So what will happen is, for those of us in this committee who belong to that, I mean, we'll still be having a committee here, and just we'll be meeting under this committee as opposed to meeting with K-12.
Right.
And then Representative Peterson, Madam Chair.
Representative Grassel.
Okay. Just a couple of questions and comments. First, just a request of you when you speak with whether it's fiscal staff or partisan staff, if in our baseline targets and in our numbers, if we can include the governor's recommendation as well. The handout we have today has the 08-09 base and then the 08-09 target. And my experience in the first term has been that we usually get to see the governor's numbers in comparison to that.
I thought you had them memorized.
Well, I do, Madam Chair.
But I don't.
I can read them to you.
No, that's just for when we.
This one was, yes.
So if we could, if this is a request, and
this was a homemade one.
That's perfectly fine. And then, second request, Madam Chair, could you for the members of this committee, could you or perhaps staff outline the path that, for example, the K-12 omnibus bill will follow on its journey to the House floor. There's, in the minority, at least in my experience, is that there's still a little bit of we don't know the path things follow. We'll learn from the path of the transportation finance bill, but if you could perhaps outline that or have staff do that, or maybe Chair Greiling's in the room now, perhaps she'd be more than willing to.
I don't have very much. The fiscal staff aren't here. My understanding is that Chair Greiling's committee will be bill will be referred to this committee. This committee will refer it to Finance Committee. Finance Committee will refer it to taxes. Taxes will send it back to Ways and Means. And then from Ways and Means to the floor.
Okay.
Unless something happens to send it back somewhere.
Sure. And then, Madam Chair, just say...
But I don't think... We're not anticipating that.
Okay. And Madam Chair, it's good to know then, so we... And I'm just mapping this out here. 1 second. Okay. And we're all learning. It's okay. The final comment I would make is just a concern I expressed in the Early Childhood Committee, and I expressed in the Finance Committee this morning, is that a lot of us who still read the bills, there's been some problems with those getting posted on the internet in advance. And the latest example of this was the transportation finance bill, which was passed on Friday. It was supposed to be in the Finance Committee this morning. I went out to read the bill last night, read it, but the first engrossment wasn't out there yet. And in terms of directing staff, if you could just have them staying on top of that, because I don't believe anyone's intending to do anything. Chair Carlson stepped in and said, we're going to delay the meeting until 6:30 this evening so members have an opportunity to review the bill. But as you know, sometimes in the minority, paranoia sets in. That, well, where's the bill? How come they can't read it? And just if you could be mindful of that, I would really appreciate it.
Thank you. Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Garofalo. We have had trouble when our staff has gotten it in, getting it on the Internet. One time in specific, we were hearing the teen screen bill in the Representative Dominguez's subcommittee, so I really wanted that up so, you know, people that are paranoid about that bill anyway didn't have one more thing to be paranoid about. And we're trying to help people who are paranoid, not make them more paranoid with teen screen. And so, but we turned it in like on a Friday morning, and somehow it didn't even get up until Monday or something awful like that. And it was not our committee staff's error. It was whoever's doing it down at the getting things up on the posting part of it. So you might check with them as well.
Representative Garofalo.
And Madam Chair, I always, whenever I use the word paranoia at the legislature, I remember one of my colleagues' comments that at the legislature, there is no such thing as paranoia because everybody is out to get you. But I wanted to, in case nonpartisan staff is listening right now, I don't want to be construed as criticizing them. I know we're sending a lot of work to them, but just speaking for myself here, I pride myself in voting, reading the legislation, and if that's not available, it can cause misunderstandings and problems in the committee. So as long as members are aware of that.
Sure can.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
I understand that completely, and we will be attentive to that. And it's not our fault. Representative Heidkirchen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Now that we have Representative Greiling here, I'll probably get confirmation from both of you. So it's my understanding that just looking at the K-12 finance bill, we're going to be going over that on a Monday, and with the department and whatnot all, and we're going to page through it. And then on Tuesday, we have the ability to go over the bill and offer amendments. And then we will be meeting with this group on Thursday, Representative Murphy's committee, and going over the bill where we also can offer still some amendments if we had to. And then it goes to Representative Carlson's committee, and that will probably be after Easter, my assumption would be, and then Ways and Means after that as well. Okay.
The taxes.
And taxes as well. Okay. Okay, thank you.
Any other questions about process? Okay. So, the time has come where the public can speak out. The last chance to talk to the chairs of the divisions. And now I lost my sheet. Here we are. Todd Otis. Ready for Kate.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair.
Welcome, Mr. Otis.
Thank you for the opportunity to comment. I guess I want to first of all say that I'm speaking on behalf of the early childhood community, people who've been involved in Head Start, ECFE, child care, other parts of the early childhood community that are all working with Ready for K to help formulate public awareness and hopefully public policy to move the needle on school readiness. It's been an effort of about 5.5 years to try to bring people together so we can speak with one voice to you. I think we've made some good progress that way. And our guiding star is actually increasing the number of kids who are ready to pay. Bottom line, moved from 50% to 80% by 2012. And a huge part of that effort is public policy. And our focus is 99% on the state legislature and the governor. So in your hands rests the power to change the number of kids who are ready for K. We want to salute Representative Slawick for the work she's done in helping put together elements in her package. The various principles that Ready for K has include expanding parent choice, making parents have the ability to have good choices. And I think that the bill that is emerging seems to embody that in a number of ways. Providing high quality programs for kids and families who particularly are at risk for not being ready for K, which correlates with low income. I think there's hopeful signs in a number of ways with regard to restoring some cuts and trying new programs that will help enable us to do that. With regard to child care, I think given the amount of resources available, that from what I've heard or I can understand to be the case, there's a real attempt to accommodate some legitimate concerns among the child care people. And there is innovation and there is good stuff that's going to be coming out of the early childhood committee. No question. A lot of people care about it. A lot of legislators care about it. But I can't sugarcoat it. This target is too low. This target of $40 million, which is a little bit less than the governor's proposal, in our opinion, is not sufficient to make a significant stride for improving the number of kids who are ready for K. An initial proposal that represented the work of about 2.5 years, looking at different strategies, different ideas, different ways of delivering quality experiences to kids at risk, to move it like roughly 50 to 60% cost about $300 million. And we tried to put our policy agenda in a way that really showed with these expenditures you get these results. We didn't expect to get $300 million out of this session. I personally thought there was a chance we could get in the neighborhood of 100. Given all that's been said about this issue, all the commitments that I've heard about it. So we want to continue to work with you. We respect this body. We respect the legislature. But ultimately, it's really about kids who aren't even aware of the legislature. We don't even know what we're doing. It's those kids who won't know what they didn't get till it's too late, who have only a limited period in that window of birth to five to actually get what they need. So we encourage you, as the rest of the session continues, to try to find ways to find more money to provide the quality learning experiences that these little kids need and deserve, and which will help our state. With that, I'd be happy to try to respond to any questions.
Representative Eric.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Otis, you said with these expenditures we get these results. What are those results?
Children who are ready for kindergarten. That is to say, on the school readiness assessment that has been done 2 years in a row and then done a third year in a different way, moving the number of those kids who are deemed proficient from 50% to 80% by 2012. That's what we mean.
And Madam Chair?
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Otis, how do we know that the kinds of dollars that you're talking about will, as you said later, guarantee that we will get these children who will or may never know? I mean, how do we know that?
Well, I'll give you an example of how we know that. One is the Department of Human Services about 2 years ago did a study of kids who were in accredited child care centers. 22 child care centers across the state. Using the same instrument of measuring school readiness that the governor and the Department of Administration published in 2002-2003, the numbers for those kids who had a really quality early learning experience were almost twice as good in terms of school readiness. So our mantra has been quality and providing really quality experiences for at-risk kids. So we know that if you give them the right inputs, you're going to get much better outputs. Now, some of our suggestions don't have the benefit of that kind of study, but we do believe that, for example, ECFE expanded to even more people than currently been able to take advantage of it can only help, because we believe that it's the best parent education program in the United States. And so there are other things such as professional development. Probably the single most important ingredient to a quality experience is the quality of the person taking care of these kids. So we do put money in for professional development, and we think that's worthwhile. So that's the basis for what we're saying. We can't guarantee it. And if I said we can guarantee it, then I'll take it back right now. But I'll tell you, we can do a lot better and up the odds of success much more if we're willing to invest in high quality of the kind that we initially proposed at the beginning of this session.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, Mr. Otis, I think your intentions are great. We want our children ready for kindergarten. But how do we get, you know, ECFE or any other entity to find all these children about whom you're speaking who may never know? I mean, how do we go about ensuring that happens? Because it has to happen at that level first before those children can receive this kind of preparation so they are, quote, quote, ready.
So how should ECFE find these kids, Madam?
Whomever. Yes, whomever.
I think we need to find new ways of reaching out, particularly to the hard-to-reach, low-income people who may not be accustomed to going to meetings at night or in school buildings. Part of our agenda focuses on trying to encourage more outreach on the part of ECFE to do that. But we need to embrace it as a goal, and we need to fund it. Because after all of the policy, at some level, we need the resources to really get the job done. And I guess what I see is so much potential here. You've heard from so many people about the value of this, the long-term benefits of it, the benefits to the K-12 system. And I would say, consider, at least as we go through the remaining weeks of this session, what would be the best mix of spending to narrow the achievement gap. We believe that the achievement gap is a really important, powerful organizing idea to try to get around solving. And we think that an important strategy is identifying the kids that are at risk for falling behind in the achievement gap and intervening early so we can save money in the future and actually make strides in narrowing that. So it's just a thought that maybe as this gets blended with K-12 and other funding, you think about what are the smartest, most proven strategies for narrowing the achievement gap. And then look at this issue versus all the other things you have to decide.
Representative Ornstein.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to thank you, Mr. Otis. I think your organization has just come a long way in a very short amount of time, and to have you, you know, as a partner up here, introducing legislation, clarifying legislation, mobilizing people at the grassroots, it's been very, very helpful to get this issue in the public eye. And so I just wanted to thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Otis.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Judy Schumacher. And I think for the rest of the testifiers, we will reserve questions until the end, make notes, and then if at the end we have questions when everybody has testified, then we'll see how much time there's left so that we can hear from all the testifiers. Ms. Schumacher.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Judy Schumacher. I'm a Family Education Department Specialist with St. Paul Public Schools. Thank you for allowing me to testify on behalf of the Early Childhood Family Education Program in Minnesota. Our goal today is to present current statistics that indicate how ECFE fits into the overall mission of this committee and to dispel the perception that ECFE is a program primarily serving middle-class Caucasian families. Over 30 years ago, when ECFE was established, that was essentially the population we serve. Today, however, the statistics have changed dramatically, as have state demographics. The following information is based upon data from the ECFE annual report and participant questionnaires in 06. Approximately 151,000 parents and 132,000 children participated in ECFE activities. Approximately 90,700 parents and 95,400 children attended weekly sessions or home visits in 327 districts. Approximately 5,000 children with disabilities and developmental delays participated. Minneapolis and St. Paul alone indicate that 52% of families participating were families of color. In St. Paul, we are located in 17 sites distributed throughout the city in an attempt to serve all populations equally. We are located in schools, in public housing community centers, and in two storefronts, one in Frogtown and one in Payne-Salem, which has the dubious distinction of having the highest abuse and neglect numbers in the state. It is critical that we continue to be available to anyone who wants our services, but especially to those in the highest risk neighborhoods. We must be in the business of prevention. It is much easier, and I might add, far less expensive, socially, emotionally, and economically, to nurture a healthy, happy baby than to try to fix a damaged child or adult. St. Paul's statistics indicate that 52% are families of color, 48% are low-income families, and 38% are English language learners, or people who speak English as a second language. To reflect these changes in our community, we have responded with the following. We collaborate with other community agencies to help families acquire basic needs for food, housing, and shelter. These include the American Indian Center, transitional housing shelters, communication services for the deaf for our Hmong deaf classes, the Eastside YMCA for our African American classes, Focus Beyond for developmentally challenged teen parents, parent education classes at the Volunteers of America Women's Correctional Facility, teen parent classes in high school, parenting classes for the English language learners at the Hub Center, 6 Spanish-speaking and 6 Hmong-speaking classes facilitated in their home languages. More than 26,800 families were referred from ECFE to other programs and services last year. We now need to provide transportation for many of our families. They just can't afford to come to us, or they have no means to do that, in order to assure access for our services. We currently have 32% multicultural staff and 23% bilingual staff, including Hmong, Spanish, American Indian, African American, and Somali. We have a diverse parent advisory council. 11 of our 26 members are multicultural. The numbers above indicate a dramatically more diverse ECFE program than it ever has been in its history. Minnesota continues to open its arms to a continually growing population of people of color and new immigrants, which in our opinion only serves to enrich our entire community. We are privileged to work to help parents become loving, supportive parents, to raise healthy, well-adjusted children who will contribute to our community and continue to raise strong families into the future. We have been part of the Ready for K effort, and we know from experience that parent education works. Their children are far more likely to be ready for kindergarten, because we emphasize that in our programs as well. We are privileged. Behind every statistic that I have just presented is a beautiful little face, or a desperate parent, or a family in need. Our programs have made an enormous difference in the lives of thousands of families. I would like to quote a couple of letters from a couple of these parents. I will read them as they are written, because several of them are from English language learners. As a 20-year-old with an infant and no help from anyone, I had no knowledge on raising a child, so what to expect in their development. I thought it would come to me after my child was born, but it didn't. I was so nervous. I was always wondering, is this normal? Why is my child like this? I was confused, scared, and nervous. I got the ECFE number from my home nurse because she noticed I had no idea what to expect. I was desperate for help, so I called. I was so happy when she showed up and had all this information for me. She asked me if I needed any resources, if I had any questions. The one-on-one interaction made me feel better because I felt like she really connected with me and my child's needs, not just a brief overlook. A full hour of interaction with me and my child. After she left, it was the first time since I had had my child I felt like I could do it. I mean, I really don't know where I would be today with my knowledge of parenting if it wasn't for my home visits. The program is truly wonderful. Second, I'm living proof that drop-in and home visitors really work hard to help the parents to support their needs because of when I first moved to Minnesota, my first contact was through ECFE. Because I was a parent who didn't like to get out, I felt lost and alone. But through ECFE, they helped me get through it all. They helped me with resources like going back to school, how to be a better parent, because where I came from, I never had the opportunity that my child has now through ECFE. And lastly, I received wonderful resources, i.e. food, clothing, medical assistance, rental loans, and many more, which I have been using all through. I truly say that if it was not for this program, my children would have been staying hungry, have no clothing, etc. I have been a domestic violence victim, and due to these resources, I know now who to call for first for help, where to turn in case it happens again, and I feel more secure today and the days to come. And yet serving more challenging populations means needing more support from you, from the legislature. Please help us to meet the needs of a continually growing, very diverse, underserved population. We cannot do this alone. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Ms. Schumacher. Patty Evans.
Welcome, Ms. Evans.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Thank you for letting me testify today.
My name is Patty Evans, and I'm asking for your support for an early hearing detection and intervention Part C coordinator, Senate File 1665, House File 1887. I brought my son here today. His name is Aaron. He's sitting over there. He's 13 years old and hearing impaired. His hearing loss was congenital, but wasn't officially diagnosed until he was 5. By the time he was 1 year old, my husband and I knew something was wrong with his hearing. He would stare at people's lips when they spoke. I think he had taught himself how to lip read. We had started having his hearing tested at the pediatrician's office numerous times from age 1 through age 5. He never passed any of the tests. He only had one ear infection, and that wasn't until he was 3. He was never referred to an ENT, even though I kept asking and pleading with the pediatrician for a referral. After he didn't pass the hearing section of the preschool screening, which I knew he wouldn't pass, I brought him back to the PEDS office, and he put a handheld device in his ear that looked like an ear thermometer and proclaimed that his eardrums were blocked, and put him on a decongestant and a nasal inhaler. Of course, that didn't work. I brought him back and said, what do I need to do for a referral to a pediatric ENT? We finally got it when he was 5. He was experiencing speech delays. The ENT quickly diagnosed him as hearing impaired and sternly told us that he should have been fitted with hearing aids when he was an infant. My husband and I cried at in the exam room and cried in the car all the way home. Aaron was fitted with hearing aids, which we couldn't afford, and we found out from a family friend about the Minnesota Hearing Foundation and Starkey Labs, which gave him his first pair of hearing aids. No one told us about resources, and we really had to dig for ourselves to find out what to do, where to go next. We never got any counseling or advice on his education or his rights, so we started checking out private schools as well as public schools. There was no system in place that notified the kindergarten screening program that we should have been referred to services. We felt that really strongly that he wouldn't thrive in a large school setting, and so we did choose to put him in a private school because they guaranteed a school size or class size of no more than 17, and he still now only has 17 students in his room. We live in Minneapolis, and we knew about Ann Sullivan Public Schools' deaf program, but knew that he wouldn't fit in there because he wasn't deaf and he didn't do sign language. He was hard of hearing, and we didn't know what other options to do except for teaching him sign language, which he didn't want to do. In third grade, the teacher kind of told us we needed to get going on something, but she really didn't know what to do. So I called Minneapolis Public Schools Special Ed and said, I need some help. They sent an audiologist for a room visit at the end of third grade and then the beginning of fourth grade, and then went over recommendations with the teachers as well as us as far as what he needed in the classroom. And he also needed speech therapy, and he was probably 7 when he started it. And I personally left work and took him to Ann Sullivan once a week for 1.5 years for speech therapy. He's in middle school now. He's mainstreamed. He does attend, for the last 2 years, he's in a learning lab in his school setting where instead of learning foreign language, he is in kind of a small peer group, very small carpeted room where he can study with peers one-on-one or with the teacher one-on-one. It would have been really great had we had for our family, had someone that could have guided us through all of this. I consider myself knowledgeable. I've lived in Minneapolis my whole life. And I didn't even hear about an advocacy group called Hands and Voices, which I'm active in, until 2 years ago, and it was just by chance that I found out about that. And Hands and Voices serves hundreds of parents that have children with hearing loss. Almost all of them have stories of fragmented services, school districts not knowing all the options and resources that are available, and parents not getting what they need for their child. I'm here to tell you my story, but ask you to consider funding this position for future families. I've learned that there are great teachers out there, financial resources that we could have tapped into,
and other supports that we weren't aware of back when he was five. If our son had been diagnosed at birth and had there been a coordinated system of education statewide in place, we and he would have not had to struggle as much and would have received the services that we needed. So thank you for your time today.
Thank you for your testimony.
Thanks.
Ms. King?
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members.
Welcome.
Thank you for the invitation. I appreciate an opportunity to be here and take a few minutes to talk about the work that you're steaming along with here in the coming weeks. We were pleased to be invited to speak to you today because the recommendation that you're working on for higher education, of course, is of great importance to us. We were very encouraged by the governor's recommendation. We were encouraged by the reinvestment in education that we see happening, and I think it plays through in the message that we have from your targets. It's wonderful to us that you're able to, that the day has arrived that you're able to invest in education at the E-12 level and at the higher education level. So we're very pleased about that. We, of course, think it's a very important area of state spending. We viewed the governor's recommendation as a good beginning and told Chair Rukavina's committee that we were hopeful that the House could do better. There were some gaps in the recommendation that started this process that are of concern to us. Foremost is funding for inflation. We would hope that you would be able to show support for that beyond what we saw in an earlier recommendation. We were certainly pleased with the focus on our strategic advancement initiatives, STEM and bioscience and allied health. We've heard from your members time and again that more nurses, more workforce development in the biosciences area is critically important to this state, and we think our proposals respond to that, and we hope you can help us in that area. And we were pleased with the support for technology. Our technology request is critically important to us, and we're really looking to you to help us. We think we've constructed a very cost-effective strategy for the investment that we need to make in our technology infrastructure. Think of it as an operating budget capital request. We can't do these items in the capital budget, or that's where we'd be. They're big dollars, we recognize that, but we would also suggest to you that if this were most other states in the nation, you'd be seeing triple-digit numbers in this area because the work is so expensive. And we think we've built a very cost-effective strategy to do that. So we would look to this body and to Chair Rukavina's committee to help us with that investment. It means better services for students, better services for the workforce strategies that we're advancing, and better services for our faculty and staff who are so reliant on technology. We appreciate the testimony that you've heard and that has been given in other committees from students about tuition. We know that tuition is a concern. It's certainly been a concern of our board. We're not pleased about what's happened to tuition over the last 10 years, and we know that that you and your colleagues have heard about it. Our board's recommendation on tuition is for what we think of as a moderate increase, and we'd be happy to talk with you about that. We've talked with Chair Rukavina's committee about it. We would hope that your priority could be state resources into the initiatives that we presented to you, and would hope that you could strengthen the target that this committee has given to higher education in order to make that possible. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Susan Hegart.
Madam Chair,
Welcome.
Members. Thank you. My name is Susan Hegart. I'm the director of the Minnesota Office of Higher Education, and I just have some brief comments regarding higher education. We're pleased to see that higher education is a priority in terms of the targets that have been set, and it's critical to the future of Minnesota in this globally competitive environment. I have 4 points that I'd like to share with you. The first is we believe and agree that it's critical to fund the public systems, MinSKU and the University of Minnesota. We encourage targeted funding the way that the systems had presented their budgets. I think the governor felt very strongly and was very pleased about the way that the systems put forward their budget requests. And so I guess on his behalf, I would encourage at least some of the funding be targeted strategically consistent with those requests by the systems, making sure that the level of appropriations are sustainable in the future, that we're able to live within our means.
You mean TALES?
Yes. Thank you. It's important also to help fund students via the state grant program. There are several points here. A couple of points here. One is that the federal government has increased the Pell Grant program by $250 a student. That amounts to about $21 million in savings. We couple the Pell Grant program with our state grant program, and we would strongly encourage that $20 million be reinvested back into the state grant program so that it's targeted to students and used for its intended purpose to help lower-income students. We also encourage your supporting the $12 million in additional funding for the state grant program that the governor's put forward. We have several ways in which I think we've previously testified here that funding would be used to benefit students, to help them with their tuition costs. Third, supporting the governor's ACHIEVE proposal, that's $78 million. That's a program that would help students pay for college and earn college credit. It encourages early preparation for college, building on proven programs like the Post-Secondary Enrollment Options Program, AP, IB, and College in the Schools, as well as some work-based learning programs. And then finally, Madam Chair and members, the GI Bill. The governor's put forward a proposal with bipartisan support. We've done a lot of work on this with the veterans folks and with the AG's office, $15 million a year. It would allow veterans who've served our country to be able to begin their education when they return or complete their education when they return. And we'd encourage your support for those programs as well. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Justin McMartin.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members, for the opportunity to testify here today. I'd also like to thank Representative Rukavina for all the opportunities that our students have had to have their voices heard in our Higher Education Committee here. It's been a wonderful experience, and a lot of students have really appreciated the openness of that committee. My name is Justin McMartin, and I serve as the state chair of the Minnesota State University Student Association, represent roughly 70,000 students in the MinSKU system. I'm also a senior at Southwest Minnesota State University in Marshall, and I'm double majoring in marketing and international business. And I know that this committee has many issues to address as far as education goes, from pre-K to college. All of them are very important to our students, and I'm sure all of you. However, we would like to encourage you to strongly consider the need for college students in your work, and how funding for higher education can help shape the success and vitality of the state of Minnesota. Tuition at state universities has gone up very quickly, an average of 70% over the last 5 years. And when cuts were made to the public higher education system several years ago, students paid the price on that. Of the $191 million cut from the MinSKU system, $173 million of it was made up for with increases in tuition. Those increases in tuition had a significant impact on our students, the lives they lead, and many worked more hours, some to the detriment of their grades and academic success. Some took fewer classes to lessen financial impacts in the long run, causing them to pay more for their education and extend their graduation dates. Some students even dropped out of school completely, hoping to earn some money from before returning back. And those are the ones that concern me the most. When I talk to young lady who went to Bemidji State University, who's now working in a small town in Iowa, hoping to save up enough money to go back to Bemidji to finish her education. Those are the reasons why I'm here. And I hope that it's something that weighs heavy on all of your minds in making these decisions. Many, however, have increased the amount of money that they're borrowing in student loans. In fact, there's a 48% increase in the amount students attending state universities borrowed between 2001 and 2005. Students graduating from our state universities in 2005 graduated with an average of $18,500 in loan debt. At least half of our graduates have debt. And at Southwest Minnesota State University, 83% of the 2005 graduating class had student debt. Not credit card debt or other debt, student debt, loans and other forms of student debt. Even though I've worked 25 to 30 hours per week at the Southwest Marketing Advisory Center, I've still had to borrow $33,000 to pay for my education, including $14,000 in private loans. Unfortunately, my story is quite typical of the students in our system and across the state in many situations. So I'm here today on behalf of those students asking for your help. An investment in public higher education is an investment in the future of Minnesota. Throughout this legislative session, students have been asking for the system to be funded at a level that will freeze tuition at current levels for the next 2 years. Additional funding will help maintain the high-quality education offered at the state colleges and universities while keeping tuition and student debt levels down. The students I serve tell me that the cost of their education has simply surpassed their ability to pay for it. They tell me that the price of tuition is simply out of reach for themselves and their families without taking out the significant amounts of debt that they have. They tell me that the decisions that they're making today are going to significantly impact their future based on the debt that they owe. For many years, the benefits of having a well-funded higher education system in Minnesota have been recognized by many legislators, and I believe the state of Minnesota as a whole. I'm talking with many of your colleagues. When I go into an office, one of the first things they tell me about is how often they heard the issue of higher education and how much our student or and how much debt our students are in. It was one of the top issues in nearly every person's district, and I think that's important to note. And we need a well-educated workforce to keep the state running, but more and more students are finding that difficult, if not impossible, to afford the education they need to be competitive in today's job market. Now is the time to reaffirm Minnesota's commitment to public higher education and to show the nation and the world that educating our population is a priority. And our students have supported the full funding of the MinSCU system, as well as an additional $73 million to fund a tuition freeze. And that totals $250 million. And the reason why we want to do that, as Dr. King had just spoke about, a 4% increase in tuition today, which is the modest increase in tuition that our board has proposed, means a lot more than it did several years ago, 5 years ago. 5 years ago, a 4% increase in tuition meant $73 to each student per year. Today, that means over $200. It's becoming a significant problem. Every little increase in tuition isn't such a little increase anymore. So we'd appreciate any consideration you can take to, or can give to this issue and any help you can show our students. Thank you very much, and I'll yield for any questions later.
Thank you very much. Scott Marmo?
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Scott Formo, and I'm president of the Minnesota State College Student Association, representing over 100,000 students from Minnesota's two-year technical and community colleges. I'm going to try really hard not to duplicate the message that Ms. King, Ms. Hegard, and Mr. McMartin have already relayed to you. And unfortunately, that's one of the drawbacks to speaking last, is trying to pick up the difference. One thing I would like to duplicate, though, is a thank you to Chair Rukavina for allowing students to come in and put the issues forth and talking about student debt and what that's meant to our students. One of the things that hasn't been touched on is the Minnesota State funding recently. Not too many years ago, the state used to fund that 80% of the cost. Students used to cover 20%. From there, it went to 67% and 33%, and then since 2003, that's been on the decline. And right now, our higher education system is being funded at 51% by the state and 49% by the students. That's leaving our two-year colleges as being second highest in the nation now for tuition, because of the fact that tuition has doubled, more than doubled in the past 10 years. Our public education system is meant to be the open access point for anyone wanting an education in the state of Minnesota. And as it has already been said, tuition has gotten out of hand and it's making it very difficult for that to be done. We too do support the $250 million request of the MNSCU Board of Trustees, which is the $177 million that the MNSCU Board has brought forth to you, plus the $73 million in tuition freeze. The target that has been set here for higher education, to me, seems low, and it's going to make it very difficult for the Higher Education Workforce Development Policy and Finance Committee to try to meet up with the campaign promises and the promises that have been made to students to address that tuition. We have worked to try to find new ways and brought new ideas to the committee as to how to fund these priorities, and we would also encourage not only this committee, but Chair Lupavina's committee to further explore some of those other ideas to find new ways to fund the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities and also addressing tuition relief. One thing that has been, that I have said on many occasions, and I would say again, that the best form of financial aid is lower tuition for everybody, and we would like to see that as still being one of the top priorities. Thank you very much for the opportunity to speak here today.
Thank you. Tom Wolfram.
Madam Chair, I'm going to pass on.
Okay. Jim Grafwell.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Jim Grafwell with Minneapolis Public Schools. I'd like to thank the team of chairs that you have at the head of the table there, absent and present. You heard every bill that I was concerned with, supported in my legislative agenda. So, number one, thanks for hearing the concerns of Minneapolis Public Schools. And I think, I mean, there's always a point in this process where I'm maybe not the only lobbyist who feels like Cinderella's stepsister is trying to fit my legislative agenda into that little silver or glass slipper of your target. You have a target. I'm sure I brought in a legislative agenda, and in your first exercise where you asked us to, you know, put a price tag on everything, I'm sure if we went and reviewed my work, my legislative agenda would cost more than your the target you have. So, number one, you heard everything we were concerned about. I'm very grateful for that. I think you've heard from Minneapolis Schools that we have students who want more time on task, either through Rep. Dominguez extended time learning, the ELL students who wanted to go to age 23, the students, for example, that wanted to do the, actually we didn't bring in the high five students, but we brought in a number of testimony on high five. Rep. Peterson has a statewide bill on that. So whether it's extended day, extended week, and we did see that great vote on the extended year, I just want to thank you for hearing the work. And I think maybe you all are at the point after last week and this weekend of realizing that even though $919 million is a good target, and I understand the property tax relief is part of that, inherent in that target, that if we're going to leave no child left behind, if we are truly going to meet that goal by 2014, I've got a bunch of school board members at the U.S. Capitol right now talking to senators and Congress people about the reauthorization of no child left behind. We're going to continue to have to put more resources in to meet that goal. So I'm happy about the investment that the House is poised to make. I am happy that the House has heard, and I forgot to mention Representative Brown's excellent bill on ending special ed proration, House Bill 833. These are critical investments, and I'm sure as you put the bill together, you'll notice there isn't enough resources, even in a target like 919, to end special ed proration, fund the formula, do all-day kindergarten, do the early childhood investments you want. So while I appreciate the focus on closing the achievement gap. I think the first time I came before Representative Grylling's committee or division, and you asked us to talk about our legislative agenda, I was late enough in the lineup that rather than talk about our individual agenda, I would ask members of this August committee to focus on a different achievement gap, which is if we have a gap between the education system we say we want and our willingness to put resources in place to fund that. So I appreciate the 919 target. I appreciate being heard all session long, and you know, I wait with pregnant expectation for what we find in each one of the division's bills. But I want to continue to work with you and support you. And I guess Representative Grylling had the only tax proposal floated out there, but I think new revenue is worth it for this public purpose, and I believe public education is at the center of the American experiment, and we need to be willing to put resources in place to make that experiment continue to succeed. Thanks very much.
Thank you. Scott Kronquist?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I do have a handout if there's... Thank you, Madam Chair, members. My name is Scott Kronquist with the Association of Metropolitan School Districts. And I would like to add my thanks to Chair Murphy and Chair Grylling and other chairs and all of the members who fought for a high target for education, for early childhood, K-12 and higher ed. Thank you for your work. We very much appreciate it. In the packet that's coming around, we have a budget survey that we conducted after the governor's budget was released. And we asked our school districts to assume the new revenue included in the governor's budget proposal. And this is the ongoing revenue for the general education program. So just to be clear, it did exclude the one-time money that the governor had proposed for the successful schools and the 3R high school program, as that money is dedicated towards that initiative. As you see, though, under the proposal, virtually all of our school districts were looking at pretty significant budget cuts, budget reductions going into the next school year. And so I thank you, members of the committee and other legislators, for hearing that message and for hearing that concern and for going forward and fighting for higher targets. Because obviously, as you can see from the results of the budget survey, it was necessary. The next handout in the packet, members, is the colorful chart. And this gives you an idea, I guess, of why our school districts were facing those budget concerns. And you will notice that if you go back to fiscal year 03 and look on an inflation-adjusted basis, what school district revenue has done, both in terms of school property taxes, which is the top green line, then the yellow line is the state aid, and then the overall total revenue for schools is the middle pink graph. And so you'll see that on an inflation-adjusted basis since 2003, total revenue for our school districts is down. The next handout, members, is the one that shows the difference between the inflation measurements, the consumer price index and the implicit price deflator. And I think this gets at some of the confusion and some of the discrepancy in information that you sometimes hear. But a number of experts, including our own Council of Economic Advisors here in Minnesota, recommend that the appropriate inflation index for governments, for local governments, including school districts, is the implicit price deflator. And as you will note, in recent years, that inflation index has exceeded the CPI significantly. And that explains to you why, for instance, when there was a 4% and 4% increase on the formula last biennium, that school districts actually continued to lose ground when you notice that the inflation measure, as measured by the IPD, was actually higher than that. The final handout, Madam Chair, is just a copy out of the November forecast. And if you look on the reverse side, which is actually page 8 in the overall forecast, there's the citation showing where the Council of Economic Advisors recommends that, in fact, the appropriate inflation index is the IPD. So, Madam Chair, again, we thank you for your work, but I would reiterate what Mr. Grathwell said, and that is that even though we appreciate the work you did in fighting for that higher target, no one should be under the illusion that school districts will be made whole under that target, that they will be able to implement new programs or even, in fact, restore all the cuts that they've made over the last 5 years. Because the bottom line is that that really is largely going to allow them to continue, for the most part, operating their current programs. Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Thank you. Grace Schwab.
Madam Chair, I understand your puzzlements. My name is Kirk Schneider, and I'm on staff with the Minnesota School Boards Association, and representing all three. Kirk Schneider.
Schneider.
Yeah, and that means long-winded in German, and so you're in for a. Let me begin by saying that we certainly do at the School Boards Association appreciate your opportunity to hear from us today as well as throughout the session. And I'd just like to reiterate what Jim had to say, is that many of our legislative priorities were also heard within the bounds of your committee structure. And I'm glad to hear that you're hearing all these bills, because they're very important to our membership. And the issue that we have before us is the issue of closing the achievement gap. There's no question that the No Child Left Behind Act is placing a greater responsibility on school districts to move their students forward. And this requires investments. And we would certainly say that this is a great start in looking at the investments, but we got to look forward here to 2014, where we have to reach proficiency for all of our students. And looking at kindergarten investment, that's one area, that one step in the direction that we believe that can close that achievement gap. And then another issue is the issue of special education. You've heard this all session long, and it's been one of the things that we've heard from our members day in, day out. Where are we at on the special ed funding component? Because we talk about the 4 and 4 that we received, but much of that, because of the cap and the proration, have caused school districts to dig into their general ed formula and help pay for those additional costs in special ed. We would certainly also encourage the restoration of the early childhood family ed piece as well. That's something that we've also heard from districts around the state who have said, listen, with the reduction in this, we've had to raise fees, and as a result, the membership or the participation at the early childhood level has decreased. And we think it's an important piece that not only focuses on the child, but also focuses on family skills as well. And I think overall, I think you have a very generous target here that I think is commendable. You've heard our issues. You've listened to our concerns, and I think that as we move forward here, we're grateful for what you've offered, but we also know, like Mr. Punquist has shared with you, that will this make us whole? Probably not, but it's a step in the right direction, so I'll be happy to answer any questions at the end. Thank you.
That concludes the number of the people that signed up previously. Is there anyone here that did not sign up but wishes to be heard? Oh my. Okie doke. But before you do, Robin Brown, the minutes are in the packet.
I move the minutes.
Representative Brown moves the adoption of the minutes as printed. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion is adopted. Okay. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself. And
Madam Chair and members, my name is Tammy Klein. I appreciate this opportunity, and I know it's running late, but I'd just like to share a very important story. I'm from Griglin, Minnesota, which is 45 miles northeast of Beaver Falls. I have three children, a daughter who's 17, a son who's 6, and a daughter that's 2. I'm a daycare parent, foster care provider, and a mom with a child with special needs. I understand that this is the best proposed budget for education now so far this session, but I do want to make a personal plea for a strong investment in our special education. If I could share my story, it's in the pace setter. It's on page 7. I won't read it, but I'll just brief you. 1 year ago, I testified at to the legislators that I had a nonverbal child. And I told them at that time, that was last March, that my dream would be to one day hear my son verbally say, I love you, Mommy, instead of signing it every night. Like I said, he maybe said 6 words. He was basically nonverbal. May 21st, 2 months later, after testifying to the legislators, on my birthday, my son said, I love you. Because of special education money funds, my child has received intense services, and because of this, he was able to make my dream come true by saying, I love you, Mommy. I just want you to know that, you know, because of this money investing into our children, it has made my dream come true, and it can make so many more dreams come true if you continue to support special education. And in order to do that, we need the money to back it up. Because of driving time, I have to take off shortly here to get back to my home. But I would like to leave my contact information. If there's any questions or anything I can help with, please let me know. But I just want to tell you, if you get a chance later, please read my story. It's great. Thank you for your time, Madam Chair and members.
Thank you for coming and participating. We appreciate it very much. Since you're going to leave, I do have one question. How did you become aware that there were special services available?
To be honest with you, it was a fight. It was a struggle. I had went through many, many agencies begging and pleading for help. I could not receive help because I was told since my child could hear and was nonverbal, he was not entitled to services. I finally got connected with PACER, who had an advocate who helped me receive services, and I am, like I said, foster parent, daycare provider. I had all the services coming into my home, and I knew what was going on, and there was nobody to help me. When I finally started receiving services, PACER, like I said, helped me, you know, get set up in the system, and ever since, it's been unbelievable progress. It's been, I mean, the speech therapist has been unbelievable special ed. I believe if I would have received services earlier, you know, we'd be that much further ahead.
What county did you work out of?
Marshall County.
Marshall County. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yes.
Yes, Madam Chair and fellow members. I am Claire Eckley, and I am president of the International Dyslexia Association in the Upper Midwest. And
Eckley?
E-C-K-L-E-Y. And I'm a parent, an advocate, and a tutor. I've been a public school teacher. I've worked with both special education and regular classroom. I just want to also say that I would appreciate your setting aside certain funding for special education, to continue the needs and to be able to provide appropriate services to students. I work with students today who are told there are no services available, or they don't qualify, or what they need the school districts don't have. And part of that is, most of that is funding. A lot of the funding, some of the funding, it gets mixed up between general ed and special ed. So I do hope that you will consider this. By funding these special education students, you're providing people like McKinsey Erickson, who spoke, some of you heard last week, the high school senior who is waiting to hear from Brown, who has been a special education student from third grade through 12th grade. And who was very aware that many children, many other students that who were her friends were not receiving services or not able to progress as well as she, because she had a parent who was an advocate who avidly fought for her to receive services. Another person I might just say is John Tuma. John Tuma, by receiving services and has been a member of this house and currently is a lobbyist, and by receiving appropriate education, he's been able to do quite well. The students need to be served, and they need to get their rightful rights. And I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Education Minnesota.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Renee Lara with Education Minnesota. We wanted to also express our thanks. I did not want to follow up on Jim Graffel's analogy of the glass slipper, but I did want to say that a lot of us would wish that this committee could, like the fairy godmother, get rid of all funding problems in the state in regards to education. But you have done...
In one swish of the wand,
one,
right?
Exactly, and that would be a fairy tale. But you have worked extremely hard, and on behalf of our membership, we wanted to thank you for that work. You've heard the relevant concerns. I did want to reiterate the issue of inflation. We think that this funding target could address, could go far in addressing the inflationary cost problem, and it could afford a 3% increase. Public schools are labor intensive, and they especially are hit hardest with health insurance costs, for example. Salaries and health and benefits are some of the biggest costs in regards to this through public education. Energy is another. Inflation is a cut on education, and every year that we have not compensated public schools for their inflationary losses, that has been a cut. And to the extent that we have prevented that cut coming out of this session, I think we would have made tremendous progress. It would not advance public education unless we fund new and effective programs such as all-day, everyday kindergarten that takes a step forward instead of tries to keep us at the same level in terms of current services provided. That is all I wish to add. And again, thank you for your attention to our concerns.
Thank you. Robin Brown, you have questions.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative. My question was, I believe Patty Evans has left, but she did have, and I've forgotten your first name, I'm sorry, Mary, that was with her speaking to the hearing loss early intervention coordinator. I had two questions, please. And I have to tell you in advance, I am supportive of this, but I do need some clarification. We know that...
Before that, will you please identify yourself for the record?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Representative Brown, my name is Mary Hartnett. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Commission Serving Deaf and Hard of Hearing People.
Representative Brown.
Madam Chair, we know that in most cases students are screened at age 4 or so, pre-kindergarten, and hearing loss would be detected at that point. And I know that at that point, IEP services would generally be available that are determined by a team. And I'm wondering, could you please explain the benefits of having a coordinator involved in this and how that would better serve our population that we're now going to be identifying?
Ms. Hartnett.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Representative Brown, We are in the bottom, to backtrack a little bit, Minnesota is in the bottom five of states in the United States for identification and reporting to the Department of Health children with hearing loss. We should be identifying about 240 children a year. Last year, we identified about 62 children. And we're way behind other states. Studies have shown that the other states that are doing early hearing identification and intervention, which is the critical piece, which is this coordinator piece where that comes in, if children are identified and their hearing loss is confirmed by 3 months and they start to receive educational services between 3 months to 6 months, they have a chance at developing, and they will develop if they have appropriate intervention, they'll have normal language development. There will be no difference between, or little or no difference between, their chronological age or and their language acquisition. Right now, with kids that haven't experienced early hearing detection intervention, the mean reading level for kids that are deaf and hard of hearing with an average intelligence are graduating with about a third grade to fourth grade reading level. We have a chance to turn that around and have them graduate with norms that are those of their hearing peers. And the way that we can do that is by having a coordinated system. You heard about Patty Evans' experience with the medical system and how that failed. It wasn't the Minneapolis public school system. I'm a proud parent in the Minneapolis public schools. It was a fragmented system that existed within the medical system. We've had a voluntary system in place for about 6 or 7 years in Minnesota. And in spite of everybody doing her great work within the Department of Health and trying to coordinate it within the Department of Education, it hasn't worked. The Department of Health right now has an early hearing detection intervention coordinator helping to coordinate those services. And they have a pretty good system in place. The problem is it's not mandated. Hospitals are not mandated to screen and report. It's voluntary. We have a bill within that has play right now that has been sponsored by the Speaker of the House that has broad support, bipartisan support, to require that a mandate be put in place, and we're hopeful that that will pass. Once we go from identification, a voluntary system, to a mandatory system, we believe that we need to have a more structured system in place. There were 16 teams that were put together across the state, early hearing detection intervention systems that were put in place to support this voluntary effort. And they have a teacher of the deaf and hard of hearing, an audiologist, and somebody from the Department of Human Services that are working to try to coordinate services. We just interviewed those teams, and they said that they could benefit so much from having somebody who is focusing on birth to five. We have in statute somebody who's focusing on K through 12, and that's really helped the system. But we don't have anybody that's picking up these new kids that we never picked up before. We were only picking them up at third to fourth grade when they were experiencing language delays, cognitive delays, emotional, social delays that they were never able to overcome before. Now they're able to overcome them because of this early intervention. So we have many resources in place. They're not coordinated. We could be leveraging other resources from Medicaid, from other sources, and utilizing those better at a lower cost to the education system and have better outcomes.
Representative Brown.
I understand that there is state dollars, federal dollars would come with this as well. Is that under...
Ms. Hartman.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Representative Brown, Part C dollars are, we're talking about special education funding today, and of course the commission is very supportive of fully funding special education and the efforts of the Coalition for Children with Disabilities, and you know we're very supportive of all of the remarks that have been made related to that. But yes, there is a federal match with Part C dollars. All of the kids that are identified through the Child Find are then eligible for, you know, special education services. The Part C dollars are dedicated to young children, babies, through the age of five, I believe, with the new changes in the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act. And they are, there would be a state and then federal match. We're obligated to provide services to the children, and this would make better use of those dollars, making sure that they have services that focus on language development, Some of the feedback that we've received from parents and from providers is that some of the children are receiving generalized services from early intervention specialists who don't have training in working with language development. So the training dollars that are in this bill would work on that, and they would also be helping to coordinate these services statewide.
Target that mandated screening and that bill for the coordinator are in which divisions?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the mandated screening has been passed out of the Health and Human Services Policy Committee and has been referred tomorrow to the. It's in the State and Local Government Committee, I believe. It's Representative Pulaski's committee tomorrow to talk about the advisory committee. We have an advisory committee in place that puts together all parties to develop guidelines. So we're there, and then it will go to finance.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Brown, anything more? Thank you, Ms. Hartnett.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Representative Erickson?
This is for Mr. McMartin.
Mr. McMartin?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. McMartin, of the millions of scholarship dollars that are available to our students, does your organization track to find out of what percentage students apply and then of what percentage students are rewarded?
Madam Chair, Representative, no, I don't have any of that information.
Madam Chair.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you. Mr. McMartin, do you know if anyone does that?
Madam Chair, Representative Erickson, I believe that the Minnesota Office of Higher Education tracks those numbers.
Okay, so I should check with
Ms. Grimes.
Susan Picard, maybe.
She volunteered, Representative Erickson.
For the record, I'm Tricia Grimes from the Minnesota Office of Higher Education, Chairman Murphy and Representative Erickson. About 75% of all Minnesota students apply for financial aid.
Mr. Erickson.
I want scholarships, not financial aid, pure scholarships, the privately funded scholarships. Do we have any idea how many students apply for those and then how many are awarded?
Madam Chair, Representative Erickson, I can go back to my office and get that, give you that information tomorrow.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And then, Mr. McMartin, Madam Chair, one more question.
Representative Erickson.
Has your organization ever figured out what the ratio of dollars borrowed today, how that compares to the ratio of dollars borrowed, let's say, 15 years ago or even 10 years ago?
Mr. McMartin.
Madam Chair, Representative Erickson, we have looked at that. I don't have the specific numbers on it. I know it's significantly higher than that of previous years. I don't have the specific numbers on it, and I would love to get you that information.
And one last question, Madam Chair.
Representative Erickson.
Mr. McMartin, does your organization ever ask students how many discretionary dollars they bring to their college education, you know, dollars that they can spend for clothing, food, parties, et cetera?
Mr. McMartin.
Madam Chair, Representative Erickson, in part of our information packet that we handed out to our two legislators this year, we had a student with an example where he was $48,000 in debt. Of that $48,000, tuition at a four-year university was $21,500. His student fees for those 4 years was $5,400. His on-campus room and board for 3 years was $8,700. He shared, for his last year, he shared rent on campus, an apartment for $3,800 and spent approximately $500 a semester for textbooks, so around $4,000 for his 4 years. So his total for tuition, fees, textbooks, and a place to live was $43,400. That would leave him with approximately $4,600 over 4 years, or $96 per month, for food, utilities, transportation, and other living expenses.
Thank you, Mr. McMartin. Thank you to everyone that testified today. Your testimony will provoke dialogue.
among the members as and the divisions as they make their final decisions on financial bills that come before us. Remember, next Monday, during this time period, we will be hearing the Omnibus Early Childhood Learning Bill. Thursday, during the K-12 time period, in the K-12 room, we will be hearing the K-12 Omnibus Finance Bill. And on Friday, during the higher ed time period and the higher ed room, we will be hearing the Omnibus Higher Ed and Workforce Development Bill. Representative Ward.
And Madam Chair, we'll be getting emails on all of those, right?
You bet.
Thank you very much.
On a daily basis, probably. No sense in changing now. Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Are these bills going to travel separately then to the House floor also?
Yes.
Thank you.
That's my understanding. This meeting is adjourned.